have to connect with the material. I have to connect with it on a very human, emotional level in some way, or I have to find something that I want to like inject into it. And it all comes from feeling.
Hello and welcome to the Now Then podcast. In this conversation, we speak to Billy Boyd Cape. We discuss how he transitioned into the commercial industry, his process of working with actors, and discovering emotion on set. This episode is sponsored by Smoke and Mirrors. We hope you enjoy.
Now then, Billy.
Now then, Billy.
I feel like we should have a brew, but we got a coffee.
Yeah, we got a coffee. It's fine.
Thank you for
Billy.
Appealing to my worst habits.
What were you just saying to me? That you never thought you could direct because you felt you were too much of a computer recluse?
When I was younger, I was very much an introvert, and I still am an introvert. And I would say that I was always sort of the nerdy kid. Could never quite figure out what my path was going to be or what I wanted to do. And I just really enjoyed watching movies in my bedroom. And that was always sort of my thing as a teenager, especially. I went to sort of an academic school. Everyone was really good at their thing. I loved art. I loved anything with coursework. I could like get my hands stuck in, but I never like was great at anything. And it sort of took a while.
That belief took a while? Because did you think you wanted to direct, or was it?
No, I think I always thought that to be a director, you're intelligent and like, I don't know, it seemed so intimidating. And at the time I was like, all I knew was I watched movies, and I was like, movies are so big. My brain could never wrap my head around that. I could never fully get it. And literally, I mean, this was like when I was like, 12, 13. And I remember when I was about 14, I watched like Steve Jobs introduce iMovie. And I was like, that's cool. Like, that's really cool. I want to, and it was just like, I want to try new software.
Yeah. I went out and bought a turtleneck.
But that was the kid. I was the kid that watched the Apple keynotes, and that was my thing. And I loved that. And I loved iMovie. I loved the idea of iMovie.
I loved iMovie at the time, though.
Yeah.
Because my first house computer, we didn't have a PC, was a Mac. My dad got a Mac.
You had a computer, lucky you.
But I was like, what is this iMovie thing? And I got obsessed with it and loved it loads. Got really nerdy with it.
Fucking hell.
What about you, Craig? Did you?
We had a coal fire and a chimney.
Oh, you had it so hard.
But like my but you have to start somewhere, don't you?
We had pigs on the table, in like buckets of hot water to keep them warm. Piglets.
Oh,
next to a piglet.
Poor Craig. It's like he grew up in 20s.
But this is not about me, anyway.
Well, that was your first photography project at school, and mine was cutting like OC sort of supercut videos, cut to block party, trying to get like 300 views on YouTube at the age of 14.
YouTube was sick.
Trying to think what the first film was that I can remember watching.
Twilight for you, wasn't it?
No.
You've told me that before, I'm sure.
Shut the hell up. Chop that one out. So we've been trying to pin you down for a while, haven't we, Billy?
I got a message from you guys nearly a year ago.
I noticed it
about
a year ago,
actually. No, actually, it would be over a year ago. I'm just calculating it because I was at my friend's birthday in Malia on the beach.
Yeah. It was just one of them things, We're just kind of like... But I'm chuffed to have you on today. One thing that's like really true about your work is every single piece definitely leaves you with a feeling of some sort. It's emotionally charged.
It's sort of like, I can't do it if I don't have the feeling. Yeah. And it's sort of everything. And it wasn't always this way, but when I sort of found maybe who I thought I might be as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, as an artist, if I'm willing to go that far, was finding the feeling of whatever I wanted to make. And I realized when I was like suddenly able to be like slightly emotionally vulnerable with myself and find something in a story that, someone wanted us to tell, a brief, hit home with me, then I could find that feeling and I could like run at it and we could have loads of fun and I could have like 1,000 ideas. And when I didn't have the feeling or I didn't have that emotional connection to what I think I wanted to make, I just couldn't get anywhere. I was like lost in the woods. And so for me, it's every time there's been the same since I was, maybe at film school, I sort of slightly started to figure it out, but even in music videos and especially in commercials, it's like have to connect with the material. I have to connect with it on a very human, emotional level in some way, or I have to find something that I want to like inject into it. And it all comes from feeling, and it's all very like abstract and tactile. If those two things are contradictions, I don't know, but it all comes down to feeling. And when I have that feeling, I feel like I'm sort of having loads of fun. And when I don't know quite what that feeling is, I get a bit lost.
Well, it definitely comes across. What was like your, you know, your first project that you really kind of got stuck into as a young filmmaker?
So I think, and we can go back a little bit about the past. In film school, I went to Bournemouth, which was ups and downs, pros and cons, I think, of any film school. You know, going to any art school, I think, has its pros and cons. You're sort of like expecting something, and what you, you know, get in return isn't quite that. But what I learned mostly was how to make really bad films, and then how to make a couple of maybe quite good films that are touching on something. And so I got to sort of see where I, you know, you look back in hindsight and say like, oh, I connected with that because I had some, you know, I had the feeling, I had something to say there. And I could work on an entire project for a year and only realize later that I had no clue what I was doing. But in film school, I made a graduation film with which was written by Molly Manning Walker, who I met at film school. It's my very close friend, DP, collaborator.
She keeps ignoring us.
Yeah, she does actually. Yeah. Tell her
she's
to.
She's very busy.
She's busy last night. Yeah.
Keeps ignoring my inbox.
And she wrote an amazing film at film school, which is called More Hate Than Fear, which was like about a graffiti writer in prison that was sort of based on her friend. And it was sort of the first time that I was sort of, we looked at like, you know, true stories, and it, where everything became about research and everything became about, you know, finding the authenticity in it. And that was a really long, big project, which we got, you know, it was the only time I've ever done a 7-day shoot, which is sort of like an amazing experience, and work on something just for a year, just one thing for a whole year. And that was probably a sort of breakthrough moment. And also a moment where you realize like, you can make really great work if you're working with your friends. And I had like an amazing team of like my producers, all the art department, Molly, everyone that worked on that was like, you know, even the composer was someone that I worked on music videos loads. It was, you can make such great work and you can really connect with the material and really get stuck in.
Because you went to university as well, didn't you, Ozzy?
Yeah, but mine was just like a DOS. It was like such a DOS. It was like, I went to like the art school in York, and it was just... It was more about the people, but it's funny because it's more about the people you meet rather than the process of what you learn in kind of thing. It was just more about who I met.
It's totally that.
Yeah. And that's what drew me to London, because of the people I met.
Yeah. I went to film school because I was sort of looking like, should I go to film school? Should I not go to film school? And I was an 18-year-old who sort of looked like a 13-year-old. Whereas I had friends who were 13 who looked like they were 20 and they were getting jobs left, right and centre. And no one would look at me quite seriously enough. So I feel like I went to film school to grow up, and that's sort of what I did, is you sort of, you meet a lot of people, have new experiences and grow up a bit and make lots of mistakes.
Yeah. Get your confidence.
Yeah.
A little bit.
And how did you kind of find your way into the kind of commercial landscape then? Cause we get a lot.
Well, a lot, I mean, the biggest question people ask, isn't it? Is like, how do you get in?
How do you break in?
How do you break in? Yeah.
I think it's sort of... I can tell you a little, you know, the short version of the path, which started mostly like when I was in my, you know, foundation year at film school, I made my first music video outside of film school. And so throughout that time in film school, I was doing sort of semi-commercial projects on the outside, pulling my friends from film school, come back to London, let's come and shoot something. You know, it's like full DSLR mode. It's like me cutting on Final Cut upgrade, me doing all the color grading. You know, we had like, it's one of those, you have £300 budget and you think like, I can do anything. And then someone came with the next video and was like, here's £1,000. I was like, I can do anything. We could do like a 10-day shoot with this. Like, oh my God, like, I could do anything with this. And so I was slowly doing that outside of film school simultaneously. So I left film school with a graduation film, but also some like really, really cheap music videos, but with a million views on YouTube or whatever.
Yeah,
that looks like a bit of clout. But the real breakthrough that I had was my very close friend was working at Academy Films as a runner. He was like, "I'm fucking off to Glastonbury for the weekend. you're the only person that I might trust enough to recommend to step in for like 3 days because you can sort of speak the language. You're sort of, he knew I was super keen. And so I got to like literally just sit in the back of their office for like 3 days. And that's, and I was a really shy kid, but I was really interested to learn. And I met lots of people in those few days. And then they called me back for a few other freelance days. And I met a few more people. And one of the producers there, I was sort of doing like some Final Cut editing because I could do some editing and treatment tweaks and all those sorts of things. I was doing some editing late night with one of the producers called Morgan Clement. And he, and you know, we were rendering. Rendering would take 10 minutes. So we'd like sit back and I'd like show him another bit of my work on YouTube or Vimeo. And then he, and I was like, do you think I should be a runner? Like, where do you think I should run? What do you think I should do? And he was basically like, you shouldn't be a runner. You're really keen. You're really enthusiastic. You've made good work. Don't sign anywhere and come back to me in a year. And that was like the best thing that anyone could have said to me. And this was like a week after I graduated. And so I basically had a year to like make something better and sort of show off a bit more. And I was very lucky, like during that year, someone came to me and gave me like what I thought was then like an earth-shattering, endless budget of £12,000 to make a music video, like a bit out of the blue. And we like stretched this budget as far as it could go. And I brought it back to Morgan a year later. And he was like, yeah, this is really, really good. Then he tried to convince me that he shouldn't sign me because he said, you will get stuck in low-budget music videos and you will never get out.
Oh, wow.
Because what you've done here with this amount of money, we couldn't do half of that spending it in the professional way that we know how to spend it. Mm. And that's basically sort of what happened for like then 3 years.
What, kind of just doing your own thing or you then did get signed?
No, I sort of like forced my way in.
Right.
Because I wouldn't really take no for an answer because all you I wanted was to like be back in the Academy office.
Right.
And
did you know that landscape? Did you know the commercial landscape a little bit, like the production companies, like Academy, you know, and all the rest of them?
So I was like, again, I like read promo news. Yeah. So I like, but really, you know, and I had a couple of videos that were on promo news, but had no real, so I just knew the names of things.
Yeah.
I knew that David Fincher was signed to Academy. And even though he's probably never done any work there before or since, I was like, that was it. It was Academy. You know, like that was the whole thing. And I had a few days like running and I ran an Academy commercial once on like a James Blake video and I thought it was just like the coolest thing in the entire world, floating a bill. And I was like, this is the best thing. You know, it was so cool.
Especially that era of like Nabil in that
exactly,
era.
Exactly, exactly. And I mean, I remember being at film school and we like, Nabil would release a new video and we'd like crowd run a laptop and watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I didn't really know anything. I just knew that like Academy was a really cool company and I really liked their work and I related to their work. And I'm lucky that I sort of maybe, you know, because what I realize now is every production company has sort of its own sort of style, its own taste, its own attitude, its own culture. And I was very lucky to sort of align myself with that, probably completely subconsciously, but I saw a type of work that I really, you know, was inspired by there.
Yeah.
And it was very, very lucky that my friend worked there.
Yeah.
But it was never, it was, you know, everyone always says like, oh, you should be like networking, which is sort of, I think, the worst word in the world. And it makes my skin shrivel still. And, but I do think like you have to be putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
And so like the moment I was in that room, I was like asking loads of questions.
Which I think is very, very important. Mm. Because the other way could be not being part of a production company, but then trying to, because a lot of the, you know, a lot of people we know now are not even signed and just kind of independent, trying to do as much kind of networking and figuring out, you know.
I think it's the wrong word for it, networking.
It probably is.
We were just chatting to someone about it. And it's a relationships industry.
It is.
That's just like full stop, isn't it? Obviously, you need to be good at what you do, but it definitely is a relationships industry. And if you're not putting yourself out there or touching base, then you're off people's minds or whatever. So there's an element of that that comes into it. But I guess Well, there's been a massive shift this year, hasn't there, in terms of like the amount of work and the amount of directors and there's a whole shift in the industry.
It's been the last 4 years.
It's been 4 years, maybe. Yeah, you might be right.
Since COVID, every year, everyone's been like, don't worry, this year it's all going to get going again. I'm like, I haven't seen it since.
I mean, a lot of production companies are going under at the minute. It's pretty crazy, isn't it? You know? I were like walking through to Shoreditch the other day thinking, when are the old days going to come back? And they ain't. It's not.
No.
And you don't want to be stuck in the mud waiting for something to come back. You just need to kind of readjust. For me, I think it's been a case of trying to readjust of like, I don't even know what the readjustment is, but I'm looking at
everything. You're still figuring it out.
I'm still figuring it out. I'm looking at everything, having a lot of conversations and just thinking about where to go really with it and what to make as well. But I mean,
I think that the dividing line that I find is that I really want to make good quality work, but I also really want to work. And I always, you know, I mean, you're sort of stuck in the middle, and wanting to work tends to not always make good work. And then you're like, who am I? I thought I was this like brilliant creative artist, provocateur. And you're actually just, you know, desperately trying to work.
Yeah.
And then there's trying to make good work. And every now and then those two things align. And it's sort of like, it's the happiest place in the world.
What would you say your ratio is then to making work and the work you put out?
It used to be, until a couple of years ago, everything in my reel was everything I'd done. And then it became, from the first ad I made, even from when I was making music videos, but especially from like the first ad I made to like the following next bunch, I basically had the perspective that I had to make the best piece of work I've ever made every single time. And I had to do better than myself every single time. One, because I felt like I was learning so much so fast about, one, how to operate on set, how the industry works, but also just like my craft was improving at such a dramatic rate. And I thought I should only ever be doing a commercial that is going to, you know, where I get to explore something entirely new, or I get to sort of double my experience. You know, maybe it's just the sound design, maybe it's just the cinematography, maybe it's the performances, maybe it's just the flow or the experience, but I wanted to improve it every single time. And I always thought I wanted to have like a reel of one film, which would be my most recent film. And in reality, the last couple of years, I'm like, that's a sport prep mentality probably, because I can't live up to myself 3 years ago sometimes, because the scripts aren't as good, or the project isn't as good, or the budget goes wrong, or you have a shit weather day, and you know, you can't always do that. But and also I became a bit lucky where I really still love some of the ads I made a few years ago. So it's, you know, I'm competing against myself a little bit there.
And when you say the first time I noticed your work or you, the first main thing was the Pride in London, I think was the first kind of thing I remember seeing.
So my first commercial was for Pride in London.
Yeah.
Which was that was when like stars sort of aligned.
Yeah.
And the sort of backstory to that was leading up to this, I, you know, was sort of presented the idea of getting signed to Academy in like 2015. And I made this 3 years later. And before that, I basically made a bunch of music videos for one artist and lost every single other picture I ever worked on. And it was like grueling. And I really thought, like, I'm going to get signed. I'm making this great work. Doors are going to start opening. And I was just like pitching and pitching and pitching and pitching for about 3 years. And I think I won one music video. And it was the worst shoot of my life, because clearly no one else in the world wanted to make this music video. And so I said yes, as like this sort of nutcase. And in this like state of desperation of like, I don't know what I'm really doing, because I'm not really excelling. I'm making good music videos. There's one artist which I'm happy about, but they're so self-grown for me that I didn't quite know where I was landing. And I got to hear the UKMVAs and you get like a little bit of taste of industry, but I wasn't really doing anything. And then I got a call from my friend that worked at Channel 4 Random Acts, which was this thing that I think doesn't exist anymore, but where they give you, you know, $5,000-$6,000 to go and make a 3-minute short. And they were basically like, do you want to go in a studio with this dancer and make a dance sort of, a dance film? And I was like, I would love to take that exact same amount of money and make a short film with a dancer. And I made this film that was like, it was called Reach. I'm still extremely proud of it. It's 4 minutes long. It's a, you know, dance motivated story about basically sort of a new father unable to sort of deal with the idea of having a child and wanting to escape from that. And I worked with this extraordinary choreographer called Bota Saver, who performed in it and choreographed it. And I made it like purely out of the love of filmmaking. And I just poured all the things that I wanted to do into this one thing, one day shoot, pretty simple story, narrative. And I really thought it was like a film that was just for me. And suddenly, like when I sort of sent it out, even to like Academy, I got like invited to the adults table, you know? And it was like, and people were like, oh, you're a filmmaker. You're like a storyteller. You're like, and I thought I made this film just for me. And I realized like, it was the one thing that people connected with, because it wasn't me trying to make a piece of like commercial entertainment or a music video for an artist or for a client. It was like something that was very pure. And I hadn't realized that how much people would connect with it. And 3 weeks later, I was pitching my first advert.
Wow. Through that, from that?
Literally 3 weeks later, I think someone else was in the bid, but I pretty much was single bid for Pride in London.
Wow.
And I walked into that room and had a very, very, very clear idea of how I wanted to make it. And we made it for a very minuscule budget. And we shot 22 scenes in 2 days. And I knew that it was one, extremely important, because it was dealing with a very, very delicate subject matter. And it was also a subject that I knew very well. And I knew what an opportunity it was. And I was very lucky that it was my, you know, you can make a really great ad for a dishwasher. And I was very lucky that my first advert was a 2 minute long performance piece with a lot of different actors or non-actors, narrative, storytelling. And it really set me up to do that kind of work going forward.
Yeah. I mean, it won a lot of awards as well.
Yeah.
Didn't it? Which...
But I think the best thing about that is that, I guess, within our industry, your career can be controlled by whatever scripts come through the door. You know, it can be a bit of a look game.
I mean, attached to that, I say...
Let me finish I'm not belittling anything. What I'm saying is, but the beautiful thing about that is that that opportunity came because of you making your own film for you through the dance, you know, piece. Mm. So that's what I always say. I always say the frustrating thing about people waiting for scripts to come through the door is like, well, don't wait for the scripts to come through the door. Go make something for you. And that, you know, it should connect with people. And that's exactly what happened there.
I was very lucky that, I hate the word luck, but I use it a lot. It was great that the stars aligned, that person from Random Acts called me and said, do you want to make a thing? Because I was desperate just to make a thing. I didn't know what thing I wanted to make though. And sometimes that's the hardest thing, is having the thing to make and knowing I should spend 6 months to a year on this very, you know, especially short films, which are wonderful self-indulgences.
Yeah.
You know, and they can be marvelous, but they have to really start as a big self-indulgence.
But it's funny because it was at the time you say being invited to the adults table. Was it the first time you felt like Academy was like, oh, this is Billy, this is him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was exactly that. It was that, but it was funny because I didn't realize that was me.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, you're, you know, I mean, I literally had an email from like the head of Academy being like, welcome.
Oh, wow.
Like, not in a way that like, welcome into the cult. We can now give you your set of, you know, your secret
your
badge. And here's how we do the handshake. It was just like, we see who you are as a filmmaker now, because all those wonderful music videos that you made, and none of them on my website now. Yeah. I'm proud of them, but none of them were me. They were me making a piece of work for an artist. And it took that other piece of work to realize that thing exactly we were talking about at the beginning, about what's the feeling that you want to, you know, and really the only thing that makes good work is finding your own identity in the work.
I love that though. It's like feeling it as soon as you feel it, and and you can see it, you can make it, can't you? But he's right. If you can't feel it, it can be a tough project.
Well, we rewatched Pride in London today, and it doesn't feel like someone who's just done one, that's their first commercial. I think that's what's quite striking. Yeah. I didn't realize it was your first one, even though it's like the first one I remember seeing, because I remember it doing really well on the awards. But it doesn't feel like a first-time commercial director to me.
That's kind.
In terms of like the performances from the actors, you know, it's not an easy thing to get someone to cry while they're singing. Do you know what I mean? There's that bit where the girl sings and literally a single tear comes down. I was like, how the fuck's he done that?
I mean, what's amazing, and it's, you know, you're not going to get that from what can I be nice? It's hard to do that for a Sainsbury's advert, you know. Yeah. Whereas if you are bringing in actors to be in an advert for Pride in London that is talking about the difficulties of the LGBTQ plus community right now, you're going to discover very real, raw and quite beautiful things and have really beautiful conversations on set and, you know, make something in which everyone on set is there to make one thing and no one is there because of the job. And that's a really hard place to get to. But every time you get the opportunity, and you get it in commercials, I've had it a lot of times in commercials, but when you get it, it's a really, really beautiful experience, and you can get really beautiful moments like that on camera because everyone's there for a reason, not for the job.
And
it's worth saying, because I sort of, I grew up in London, I grew up in fairly central North London, Kentish Town. My mum is a casting director. Mainly, she's always worked in stills advertising. My dad is a photographer, but has always worked in sort of like strange multimedia digital projects. And I have a stepdad who's an actor, who's been on all sorts of things from kids TV to Coronet Corrie and, you know, all sorts from Harrogate. And there's like a Venn diagram there of where a sort of director can meet in the middle. But I never was on set growing up and I never really realised that. But I've had this sort of, these learned experiences from them of having three freelance parents who creatively find themselves in their work. And what the most beautiful thing about the Pride in London project was I was able to ask my mum to cast it.
Oh, wow.
And it was funny because she's always worked in stills advertising, been always amazing at it. Always worked with trying to find real people. And she'd never really done lots of video stuff. And that was sort of, and now she's almost cast all my adverts since. And we have a very different relationship because we have this work relationship as well. And she's sort of like become quite prolific and extremely successful casting commercials. My everything for me in terms of that kind of project starts at casting. And I have a very sort of like, you know, our casting studio growing up was literally inside of our house. So the upstairs living room would convert into a casting studio. And literally when I was, you know, from being a child, there would be castings happening in the house while I'd be eating my cereal for breakfast in the morning. And so like there were always just actors flowing through our house. And often it was, you know, it's not scripted work. It's characterful faces or unusual people or real people. My mum was very good at casting real people. You know, literally, I remember as a child when I was like age 10, we'd be walking down like Camden Market and she'd be like stopping people in the street and like handing out a piece of paper, being like, please come to my casting studio, please come to my casting studio. I need to find 12 punks for this like, you know, New Diesel campaign. And that was sort of very much part of me growing up. So Pride in London was finding people that lived the stories that we're putting on screen. And that's what I've always tried to do, is not just find real people who are like, oh, what, we need a plumber in the scene, let's find a plumber, but someone that has an experience that they are bringing to set that can improve everything that's happening on screen.
So how does your casting process, what does that look like then? Because obviously now it can be quite difficult where you get sent a tape and then you meet, that sometimes the only time you can do a casting is through a screen, mm-hmm. which I actually find really tough. It's always better, obviously, when you're meeting someone in real life. Like, would you be able to talk us through that process a little bit?
Yeah, I think I always try and keep it flexible. I try to not preempt what I want someone to look like. But again, it comes back to feeling. And I try and describe what I want that person to feel like as a person. and whether that is the person for real or whether that's a really good actor being able to bring that to their performance. And then I much prefer, once I've seen that first self-tape, I think you know pretty quickly when someone embodies the feeling that you want them to embody. And then I really just try and talk to them and see if I can find a rapport with that person. Much more than let's do five takes of that thing and see if you nail it. And you have to do that for the client, but off camera, it's me seeing if I look into their eyes and they look back at me and we have a dialogue. Because I think that's, if you don't have that dialogue, you're never going to get anywhere on set, especially under the stress of everything else that's happening.
Yeah.
And really, in terms of casting, I generally believe that 90% of the job is good casting. And 10% is like faster, slower, louder, no, please walk this way. Or, I mean, really, you know, amazing actors or amazing people who are comfortable on screen are bringing that themselves to everything. And hopefully we're just going to shoot them really, really well. And, you know, so for instance, the amazing girl that cries while singing, she came to the casting and she did an amazing job crying while singing. And we had big conversations on set and she brought that same energy again. And it was really beautiful. And it was very much her. And we were very lucky to find her. And she wasn't who I had imagined for that role, but it was someone that came and surprised me, surprised us.
It's amazing. It's a good, yeah.
It's a beautiful piece.
I was going to say as well, do you then, because of the situation you get put in with Pride of London, right? It does really well. Which then obviously each time you're putting quite a lot of pressure on yourself to do better and better and better. Did you feel then that you, were you ever picky then with the scripts that came through and what you chose to do to follow that?
So two quick things. One thing is it did really well. It was about a year till it won an award.
Oh, right. Wow.
It was very, like for me making it, thinking this is going to open all these doors, and it didn't. And I didn't. The next time I did a commercial shoot that was not extraordinarily low budget was a year later. So like the reality of, you know, the Instagram reality of, wow, they're so busy, they're so successful, wow, look at all those awards. From the inside, it's never like that. And I won my first award for that, which was a huge surprise in a very sort of beautiful moment, was a year later of shooting it, and I just wrapped a job that day. And it was my first job after. So it wasn't like, wow, I'm top of the world, like I've made this amazing piece of work. It was like, I really just need to work again.
Yeah.
And I really need that next piece of work to be good. But I find it hard. If I'm going to work on something, I really put everything into it. So my expectations are very, very high. And otherwise I won't pitch on it. And I do say no to most scripts. And I'm not saying that there's loads of knocks at the door, because there really isn't. But I really have to find that if someone wants me to pitch on something, I have to find that there is something that I always describe it as, need to get my teeth into something. Like, I've done this advert before. I don't need to do this advert. Yeah, it's not going to get me the job after this. It's just going to maybe keep me busy for a couple of months. And I have much less interest in being busy than making better work or challenging myself or, you know, sometimes there's a script that's quite good and I find an angle that lets it be something more. And so I have to, so sometimes they'll say, do you want to pitch on this? And it's going to be like, give me 48 hours because I need to figure out whether I'm going to pitch on it before I say yes or no.
There can be a lot of pressure when you get that email as well. Because the people need to know, because they're like getting your reel together and putting you forward or whatever, you know. Because obviously there's that process, putting you forward if the agency says yes, or I don't know.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff, I don't know.
The scariest thing is when you get a pitch in, you're like, oh, I've been desperate to do something. This looks pretty good. Yeah, I'll do this. And you jump on the call, you know, like the next morning, like straight away. And then you're like, oh, cool. The call went really well. They're really enthusiastic. I'm really enthusiastic. I think they like me. I think we can gel. And then I start writing the treatment and you start breaking down what they've written and you realize like, oh no, none of this adds up. Like, they don't know what they've written. That's why they've come to me. I, you know, and now I can't bring those things to it that I thought I could bring to it, because they've already got themselves in a twist and a bind, and you get into a really sticky situation. The projects that I do win, and there's lots and lots that I don't win, the projects that I do win, I tend to find that it's like a half-baked idea that I've been able to, like, redefine.
And like, do you enjoy that, doing that?
I greatly enjoy that.
Yeah.
I greatly enjoy that. Not saying like, oh, this is a bad script, I'll make it a good script, but like they say, we've got the voiceover, but we don't have the visuals.
That's fun.
Let's talk. And I'm like, great, this is a playground. And when there's a script that's like actually just really good, I never win this, because there's another director who's 10 years more experienced that can walk in and be like, yep, I'll do it. And they just walk away with it straight away. And really, every time I think I've won a job, it's been on the basis of like, I brought something to the treatment that the treatment did not have. And every time I see a job that I lost and was really sad about losing, I watch what the other director did. And 95% of the time, I'm like, oh, I would have never done that. Like, thank God I didn't do that. Like, there was no way I was going to make anything like that. So thank God they didn't give it to me. And you know, and sometimes you watch it and you're like, that's brilliant. But like, yeah, never would have done that.
So you enjoy taking it and writing and getting deep into the writing process and bringing your own kind of thoughts to it all.
Yeah, as much as possible.
Yeah. Because I know, you know, there's a lot of directors who you know, don't even write their own treatments, which I just, you know, I don't know.
We can. We can.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another thing.
I
don't know how that works, but then my treatments operate based on like storytelling. Everything comes down to the storytelling. Who are the people? Where is the heart? Where is the story going? What is the ABC? You know, it's. And I think a lot of other directors, they have a really good style and they know how to execute that style based on sort of a variety of material. Whereas, you know, for me, it's all about finding the story and then telling the story as well as it can be told. But you guys are very similar, you know, you're storytellers.
Yeah, but I feel like maybe especially in the past few years, you know, you just want to work for the sake of working, and that storytelling can sometimes get lost, because I've kind of fallen into a very like fashion heavy stuff, and the scripts are coming where there's hardly, and you know, it's not really storytelling. It's kind of executing something that can show a top and tail of someone's outfit.
Yeah.
And that's what they need.
Yeah.
And it can be, you know, if you say, I need a close up of someone's facial motion, they're like, no, we don't see.
Any. See, those are the ads that I sometimes would love to do, but I never win because they're like, well, the other person can shoot that way better. And if there isn't something for me to like dress up.
Yeah.
But
it's a muscle.
It's being able
to be on set and talk to people and use the camera, work with a different crew and learn. It's all about learning. So, you know, I don't think it's a...
Hey, no disregard to fashion stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
I do enjoy it. You do enjoy it as well. But you're very good at it.
Yeah. But it's the storytelling aspect you end up missing.
No, I mean, I've always... I always really wanted to work in more fashion-based projects. And I mean, it's that funny thing where, like, you don't really get to choose what kind of director you are.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a solid line.
For a long time, I tried to, like, choose, I'm going to be this kind of director. I love this style. I'm going to do this style of work. I love, you know, and your mood, you build a mood board, you build a deck that looks just like that, and then you have no clue how to execute on it. Or you just can't execute on it. I mean, Ian Ponsdale, who I think is extraordinarily talented and a lovely man and a crazy workaholic, there is now like 1,000 little Ians, and I can't watch television anymore because it just looks like there's little Ians making little Ian work. While Ian has matured into making way more sophisticated versions of his own thing. And he really, you know, he designed that style, he founded it, and it's really amazing when you see someone literally just do something because that's how they see the world. And I don't think you get to choose how you see the world, really. You have to sort of just learn how to articulate it.
Mm-hmm. Very true. It's so funny, loads of little Ian's talking about. Loads of probe lenses.
It's loads of probe lenses.
Yeah. I was knocking about.
Okay.
I used a probe lens once. It was cool.
Me too. Yeah. I didn't mind it. It was for someone doing a chess move.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you enjoyed that one.
I did, yeah. It's the first time I used it. I was like, oh, it's all right. Whoa, it's so big.
It's funny, though, with all that kind of like what you're saying about you are who you are as a director, not trying to be anyone else. Because I always find myself to be so commercially unsellable. And the more I'm, you know, getting into what I'm doing, the more unsellable I'm becoming. Do you know what I mean? But then it kind of, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I feel like it's put me in a bit of a cage almost.
No, but I think, honestly, most of my agency calls that I hop on now, they're like, by the way, we love your work, but we really don't want this to be sad.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I made a commercial about Alzheimer's. Of course that's going to be sad. Like, this is literally...
Yeah. You're going to make something happy then, Billy.
Well, I'm trying to. Yeah. Yeah. Well, no.
Now that you're a father as well, that must have changed a lot of things.
I mean, I don't think my work's as sad as everyone says it is, but...
It's a warm sad, though. It's not like a depressing sad.
I just think that feeling, as we were talking about, is everything that is happy or everything that is interesting has a different edge to it. There has to be a tension or a conflict that's underlying that, or it has to come from something, because otherwise why does it exist? So if you just want something to be really smiley and happy clappy, you're not really making anything, I don't think, that's got any, you know, that's going to have any resonance or last longer in the mind of the audience than the amount of time they're watching it.
Which literally gets back to our first point, which we said, where it was like, we felt like your work left us with something every single time we watched it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It stirred us up, didn't it? It wasn't like a, it wasn't sad, it was moving.
That's good.
Yeah. Little bit sad.
A little bit sad.
We didn't cry. No.
I loved it. But how are things? How are things now as a young father? You were saying outside, it's changed your perspective.
Yeah, it's changed my perspective. I mean, one, you suddenly, you know, I've always been felt like the youngest person in the room, or treated like the youngest person in the room, or looked like the youngest person in the room. And now suddenly I'm sort of bringing a child to nursery every day, and I'm suddenly doing these very mature things, and I'm suddenly thinking about where my life's going to be in 10 years, and I'm suddenly thinking, I don't want to work all the time. And if I do work, it's got to be worth it, because I have this amazing thing at home that I could be spending time on instead. And you also start thinking about, oh, that's going to be expensive. We've got to have that. And yeah, we're going to have to pay for the car. And some of us aren't going to be working all the time because we've got to look after a child. So it really changes your priorities. And really, work used to be 100% of everything. And now I have another full-time job, and it's being a dad. And that job is probably more rewarding sometimes than work is. And I love both those jobs, both those parts of my life. And it's sort of, I'm still figuring out how to fuse them, because you can't give everything to both. And that's really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I think, you know, I'm learning about that.
Because you've always said you wanted to do a film before you do have a kid.
I used to say that too.
Yeah. But you've done so the one thing we were trying to find your short film is Wings, but it's not out to the public.
It's not out to the public. It's in short film world.
Yeah.
Trapped in the short film box of
festival rounds.
Of festival rounds and secret emails, people saying, oh, I really liked it. And then screenings that you don't know anything about what happened to that film. I'm really proud of that short. I made it with a writer called Sonia Hill, and we wanted to make it just before lockdown. Then lockdown happened, and then, you know, and now we're in 2014. Well, no, now we're in 2024.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something like it's 5 years later. And that's sort of, you know, the strange journey of short films. I've been talking about the short film for 5 years. But I worked on this film with this writer called Sonia Hill. It was her story. It's really about her, relationship as a mother to her son. And then... while we were making it, she suddenly developed bone cancer and thought she had a couple more years left, and we were still planning to make it. And then she died a few months later during lockdown. And it was sort of, I mean, it's earth-shattering, but the film was her film. It was her story. It was about her. I was making it because I wanted to tell her story, because I thought her story was beautiful. And then I was making it without her. It was very strange. was very, very sad and also very beautiful. And so, yeah, the film's sort of still living on a bit.
Mate, that's so heartbreaking, mate.
It was really sad, really heartbreaking. And it was so funny because I sort of we started the project being like, we definitely don't want to make a film about grief. And then the film came about grief. Oh. And it's nice because it's her work gets to live on a little bit longer. And she's an extraordinary writer with an amazing voice. And it was very hard finishing it without her because really I was trying to make her story and then she wasn't there. So that was difficult. I'm very proud of the film. I sort of set myself the challenge of working with kids and animals, which was, I thought would be a fun test, but it was a fun test.
Yeah, a crow? Did you have a crow?
We had a crow and a young lad, yeah.
Oh, well, I'd really want to see it double as much as I did before now.
Yeah, I would love to see that.
Maybe. Yeah, send it to
you guys. Yeah,
I actually just need to figure out how to get it online and it not just sit on Vimeo, which is probably what they do, isn't it? That's the real thing. It's like...
Now, Vimeo's not even fun anymore.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Sorry, Vimeo.
I think I'm a big nerd, but Vimeo, I literally just don't know how to get to the copy link button quick enough. Like, yes. It's just so, you keep moving it. I can't find it.
Or
I can't
get to it. Like, downloads. Like, that. They've shifted that.
It's so complicated.
Yeah. Or just how to search any video.
Yeah.
Fucking nightmare.
But yeah, I would love to see it. And with that, are you, I'm guessing from the short then, is that the trajectory you're thinking you want to go into drama and features?
I would love to do drama, yeah. I mean, I see every commercial as an exercise in learning and I would love to do drama. It's you start realizing that it's even more competitive than commercials and it's even harder and it's even slower and the budgets are even more difficult, etc. So, but I'm whittling away. Writing, doing lots of writing, but trying to, you know, I had this amazing experience when I was 21 where I somehow got the credit of producer on a documentary. It was a feature documentary called Beyond Clueless, which was made by this extraordinary filmmaker, Charlie Shackleton. And it was a film essay about teen movies. It was like the nichest subject that you could do. It was a film essay, 90-minute film essay, literally about the era of teen movies between like Clueless and Mean Girls. We didn't shoot anything.
It was just like,
and it got into South by Southwest. And so I was in South by Southwest with this team and, you know, you're there and it was amazing. And I was like still in second year of film school. So it was like this like very sort of out of body experience. We were all like 21 and you look at the list of films and there's like 200 films that is premiering at South by Southwest, one of the most competitive film festivals to get into. And then you look at this list, but you're like, two of these, three of these are going to hit the consciousness of like the public. We actually got onto Netflix somehow, but that's because our film was so cheap that Netflix could buy us quite cheaply. But you realize that it's really, not only is it hard to make a film, it's hard to get an audience for a film. But I'm whittling away on that. Yeah.
Molly can help you, can't she? She's done all right.
Molly's an inspiration. Molly's an inspiration. Isn't it? She made, I think, yeah, one of the best British films of the last 5-10 years.
Yeah.
It's really, I'm extraordinarily proud of her. And she made that through her own pain and blood. And it's an extraordinary film.
I think we're all done there.
Me too.
Aren't we?
Me too. Hey, I mean,
I tell you what, Billy, I've absolutely loved listening to you.
Me too.
Really enjoyed it. Kind of. I guess through such a difficult part of the industry, how it's going right now, it's been really nice to listen to some of the words that you've said. You know what I mean?
Very eloquently spoken as well.
I didn't quite know it was going to come out.
Well, I can see everything comes from a really good place. That's what I can see. And speaking to you now, I can see why you make the work you make. So that's
it. I can definitely see the Billy in the work now. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, mate.
It's great fun.
Really appreciate it.
Should we have some beers?
Yes.
Let's do it. Nice one.